due to the graphic nature of some of the content in this episode, listener discretion is advised. I've gained a lot of wisdom from my dad, usually through knee slaps and laughter. Thanks to him, anytime someone brings up the word assume in casual conversation, I can hear his voice in the back of my head, cracking one of his go-to puns, cautioning me not to assume, lest I make an ass out of you and me. It's an old corny joke, but over the years, I've seen this lesson ring true time and again. Operating on assumptions can lead to boatloads of embarrassment and confusion. It's far better to enter into situations confident in what you know, ever cognizant of what you don't. In diving into this case, I've tried to ground myself in that mentality, processing experiences without jumping to quick conclusions. Objectivity has led me to some interesting places, and with it in mind, I've investigated tips I would have otherwise discounted, doubting they would lead to any of the answers I've been looking for. But with the case so mired in secrecy, I've had to remind myself that I may not know what I'm looking for, and I wouldn't want to make an ass of myself pretending like I do. My name is Freddie, and this is Unforgotten, a podcast series chipping away at the layers of a long and awful mystery. The unsolved murder of Matt Stewart.
Back in June, a husband and a wife were asleep in their upstairs bedroom here when a stranger came in, brutally attacked, and killed the husband.
It was personal.
Why isn't he dead in the bed?
There was a person.
She cleaned up everything.
No one heard gunshots.
No one heard gunshots.
Somebody had snuck into the house and had hid out somewhere, and that's how they had gone into the home.
She told me she knows who did it.
The mattress was covered in blood.
Last summer, in interviews with Matt's sister and another family member, I caught brief, ominous references about a person close to Matt who had apparently drawn suspicion in the aftermath of the murder. Following those initial conversations, I've spent weeks trying to connect the dots, picking the brains of various people who have knowledge of the community or Matt's extended family. From a handful of different sources, I heard about this inter-family dispute and a guy named Clay. Clay's grandfather served as the police chief in Mooresville during the mid-1950s. After Clay's grandmother died in 1965, his grandfather married Jean, Matt Stewart's maternal grandmother, who's been mentioned repeatedly throughout this series. Like his grandfather before him, Clay has had a long career in law enforcement. He grew up in Mooresville, but for over a decade has been living and working elsewhere in the state. Eventually, I felt I had done enough speculating and got up the nerve to make a phone call.
My name is Freddie Wilson. I'm working on a story on an unsolved murder, and I wanted to see if you'd be willing to talk with me about it.
Tell me what you're working on.
Well, there was an unsolved murder in 2009 in Mooresville of a man named Matt Stewart.
Yeah.
About 6 months ago, I started a podcast series looking to bring attention back to the case. Kind of gone on rabbit trails and everything, and I understand that you're somehow related with Matt. And your name has come up a couple times, and I just wanted to reach out to see if you'd be willing to speak with me.
Yeah, sure. I don't know how informative or helpful that I can be, but man, I'd be glad to talk to you about it. I'm super curious, what context my name, how I would be sort of brought up in the course of the conversation about that.
Would you be willing to speak on record, or?
Yeah, sure. I have no problem with that. I'm unfortunately, I don't know that I can be very helpful or offer anything that you probably don't want to already know. You've been following this, it sounds like, for some time. You're probably a lot more informed about it than I am, because we weren't very close.
You weren't close with Matt?
No, not really. But you say my name comes up when you discuss the topic with people?
Yeah. It's come up a couple times, and I don't really have a whole handle on the family tree. I've talked with different folks in the family. His immediate family is no longer working with the podcast. How exactly are you related to Matt?
Matt was my step-grandmother, her grandson. Because my grandmother died before I was born, and he remarried. And his wife, Jean, already had a few grown kids. One of the kids, the daughter, she is having Matt and his sister. Of course, they were both much younger than I was. My life had taken me to the military and college, and even out in North Carolina. I mean, I very, very rarely saw that side of the family. I used to see Matt's mom and dad more regularly as a child growing up, like during Christmas functions and things like that. I'd go to my grandfather's house as a kid. Heck, he wasn't even born yet. By the time Matt came along, and I rarely ever saw him. The last time I saw Matt was actually at my grandfather's funeral. I was surprised. It had been so long since I'd seen Matt that I was surprised that he had, he was grown up. He had his own family. He had a couple of kids with him. I was like, holy smokes, man. Last time I saw him as a kid, now he's a grown man with kids of his own. So, but that just sort of indicates how infrequent our paths crossed.
You weren't super close with Matt when this happened. I mean, did you have other family contacts that had been close with Matt, or was the family kind of separated at the time he was killed?
I would say probably separated, for no other reason, just circumstances. All of us had our own families by then and so forth, and I'm not aware that they even, corresponded or anything. It's fair to say they probably were just as out of touch with Matt as I was.
So what I'm trying to get to the bottom of here, basically, the more that I've looked into this, the kind of weirder it's gotten for me. Kind of the further I've gone with this thing, I've gotten some interesting calls from the family trying to get me to stop looking into it. And
really?
It's been, yeah.
I'm just really curious, is it because that they are not wanting these old wounds reopened and have to relive this type of stuff?
When I started, that's kind of what people told me. They said, they don't really like to talk about it. Obviously, it's very painful. But no one told me not to do it. They just kind of said that I shouldn't talk to Matt's wife. I shouldn't call his parents. But as it's kind of gone on, what they're saying now is that I'm putting them in danger by talking about the murder, and that's why they want me to stop.
That sounds obviously very conspiratorial. I mean,
I'm not going to beat around the bush. So your name has come up in terms of people that didn't like Matt.
Well, that's completely incorrect. I mean,
I'm not one to call you to stir up anything or to. I want to get to the bottom of this. I wanted to get your take on everything as to why people might think that.
I'll be candid as far as to say that, when my grandfather died, there was some hard feelings in between my dad and especially Matt's mom concerning the estate, And I suppose that's oftentimes the case when you have split families and somebody passes away. And there was some hard feelings, and there may, it got to the point, where attorneys involved. Hey, I never got you have to speak on depositions or anything like that. I was sort of outside the fray, concerning that whole thing. But I suppose that if there's some gossip out there that says, that Clay didn't like Matt, it could potentially be related to some of that. But I'll tell you this. The funeral, my grandfather's funeral it was rather awkward, man. In that there were two sections of the funeral home that had to be sort of reserved, and they sort of split up the family so that my dad and my uncle and their families, my cousins and brothers and sisters, we were in one side, and then Bonnie and Jean, my step-grandma, their whole families were on the other side. And so it was really weird, and I didn't have any problems with that side of the family. I really didn't know them well enough, and the ones that I did know at the time, I got along great with my grandmother.
There was maybe some conflict, but you were pretty much out of the fray at that point.
Man, I totally was. In fact, it got to the point where I actually sort of, I don't know if you want to call it broke ranks or whatever, but I went to the other side. I mean, my grandfather was actually over there laying, you know, laying in state, I guess, you know. So I felt like I was in the wrong place. And so I actually went over there. I was standing in line with him. And Matt happened to be beside me. And that's when we got a chance to just briefly talk. And, you know, I think he talked about his kids. And the thing probably about that whole situation, the whole kind of awkward funeral situation that speaks to my mind more than anything, is that it's something Matt said. You know, here I was, my family was basically in another section of the funeral home, and I'm standing over here. I said something like, you know, hey, it's kind of weird or something. And he said, he just kind of looked at me and smiled, shook his head, he said, just pray for peace. I just thought that was the perfect thing to say.
This conflict kind of came up. That's why I wanted to get to the bottom of what the real story was, if there was a story.
Having hearing you say that, I can appreciate if you're serious about getting to the bottom of it, you'd have to make this call. Yeah.
But what I'm getting from you is this whole family conflict probably wouldn't have escalated into that. It probably has no relation.
I can say, you know, I mean, I'm intimately familiar with everybody on my side of the family that would have, even my uncle and his kids and stuff. I mean, man, it is so far out of the realm of reality that anybody would be even capable to consider doing something as heinous as that. I mean, I just can't imagine, let alone carrying it out. I mean, the last time I saw Matt, he was, you know, a pretty fit dude. I mean, you would have had to, you know, he could have been some old man or two-thirds of them out right off the top, you know. If there were people who entertained the idea of me doing something like that, I wouldn't be surprised based on a composite sketch that was put together at one point. But if it was based on my character, man, or the way that I felt on Matt, it just would be, you know, just no basis for that, man. Last time I saw Matt, I was impressed with him, and I thought he said an amazing thing and had an amazing attitude, and you know, that's what I was left with. I remember seeing there was some, you know, sort of sketch that was put out. It was like a shaved head, scruffy face, tall guy. And you didn't have to be too imaginative to say, oh, this looks, it kind of sounds like me, you know?
I was under the impression that you were questioned by police about this.
Well, I talked to Quinn and DJ, the FBI guy.
The Quinn Clay is talking about is an officer working Matt's case for the Mooresville Police Department, and DJ is an investigator for the State Bureau.
I mean, if you want to consider an official, like, I guess, questioning or interrogation, I mean, I guess it could be characterized as that. But I worked with Quinn. I was a cop in Cornelius. Quinn and I both hadn't been in law enforcement very long. I mean, that might have been his first patrol job, and that was mine. So we were sort of, you know, cutting our teeth together. And I went to Davie County Sheriff's Office after that and had an office practically right beside DJ Smith. He had a satellite office there to the Sheriff's Office. I knew both these guys, and so when I got a call and they said, hey, can we talk to you about, you know, man, you know, no flags went up, like, oh my gosh, you know, they're laying a name. I shot the breeze with them like we were, you know, just, you know, talking like we always talk. You know what? I'm not sure, they may have even had, this has been a long time, man, but they may have had the sketch and asked me if it reminded me of anybody or anything, and I remember telling them, yeah, me, chuckling them off, you know, because, I mean, I assumed that they knew that I was capable of doing something as horrific, you know, that. It's kind of sad to think that, you know, that there are people who have those questions in their minds about me.
Well, I mean, was there any talk in the family about what this could have all been about?
No. I'm actually trying to think if I've even talked about it, if we've even discussed it as siblings or anything, other than to say, you know, holy cow, it's crazy, you know. Probably going to be something that's on my mind for some time now. Well, I'm impressed by you, and I admire your tenacity, man. So it takes a lot of guts to pick up the phone and call people. I think there may have been some talk early on, and heck, you would know whether or not this is actual stuff, but I do recall that there was some rumors floating around about his mother-in-law was stopped in the neighborhood while the police were still on the scene after having had a feeling that something had happened and decided to go up there.
On the morning of Matt's murder, the only member of the family who wasn't in the house was Matt and Angel's oldest daughter, Hannah, who was sleeping over at a friend's house just a few doors down on Shepherd Hill Drive.
I went down to a friend's house to have a sleepover two doors down, like I did almost every weekend.
There's been a lot of speculation about this sleepover. Hannah and many others in the church community view it as one of the many little miracles that happened in the midst of this colossal tragedy. But more skeptical minds may see her absence on this night as suspiciously convenient, even more so in light of the claim we heard last season that the night of the murder had been the first time Hannah had slept over at a friend's house in her life.
I knew Hannah had spent the night for the first time in her life with a friend. Okay. The first night she just so happened to be spending the night with a friend.
Pastor Wicker is just one of several people I've spoken with who was under this impression. But over time, I've come to believe Hannah that these sleepovers did happen regularly, especially after talking with the mother of the young girl whose house Hannah was sleeping over in, a woman named Michelle.
The night of the murder, Hannah was over at your house.
Yes, sir. They were both asleep in my daughter's room. They were always staying. Normally, Hannah would stay over here. She was there.
Did you say that Hannah usually stayed at your house, or did your daughter usually stay at Hannah's house?
Normally, Hannah would stay here. I think.
Oh, really?
I think my daughter might have stayed there a few times, but more so Hannah would be over here.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, that's different than certain people were saying it was the first time she slept over at a friend's house.
So she
definitely slept over there before.
Oh, yeah. We had Hannah here all the time. Sometimes she would stay the night, and sometimes she would just come over and hang out, you know, with my daughter. Okay.
Not only did Michelle confirm that these sleepovers were routine, she also corroborated other important details in Hannah's story, notably that this sleepover wasn't planned out in advance, as some may have speculated.
Hannah wanted to stay over at my house. Well, Faith had asked her, my daughter Faith had asked Hannah, you know, hey, you want to spend the night? And she said, let me go ask my mom. She came back and she said, my mom said it was fine, but normally my mom has to let my dad know too, but my grandma was there and my grandmother said it was fine too. So I said, okay.
Her grandmother was there at the house?
Yes. I'm asleep. And then Danielle started calling my cell phone and blowing it up because I didn't even hear that for a while, I don't think. And I finally answered my phone and she said, Michelle, you know, she's all in a panic and something bad has happened. There's been an accident. You know, we don't know about Matthew. He's still in the house and Angel got shot. And she says, okay, the police is going to be ringing your doorbell any time and you go answer it. Of course, my doorbell rings and by this time it was like 1 o'clock. Let me tell you, like, when I answered my door, and so I asked who it was, you know, obviously I'm not going to answer it until they told me, and they said, police, open up. So I opened up, and they said, yes, ma'am, can you tell me, is there a Hannah Stewart here? And I said, yes, sir. I said, she spent the night with my daughter, their best friends, and they're asleep upstairs in my daughter's room. And he said, okay, well, there's been an accident at her house. Yeah, that's exactly what he said. And I said, what kind of accident? And he said, Angel had been shot in her wrist or braced in her wrist, and then they don't know about Matt, but he was still inside the house. But they don't know anything else. And they said, listen, this is what we need for you to do, talking to me. Stay in your house. Shut all your blinds. Do not, you know, open your blinds for any reason. You couldn't hear a pin drop in our neighborhood. No lights, no nothing. At this point, I was shaking. I was like, oh my gosh. And I called my parents. I said, Mom, Dad, you know, you guys got to come over here. And by the time they got here, it was like 2. They couldn't get down my road because it was blocked. They had to go around.
So they went down Northland.
They had to. The police made them go all the way around. They could not turn down Shepherd Hill.
You said you know Brenda, the mother-in-law. Was it your understanding mm-hmm. that she was at the house at the time that this happened?
As to my understanding, she showed up after the fact, is what I was told. And when she showed up in her SUV, the police immediately went up to her, and because she was going to go inside the house, and they said, no, no, ma'am, you cannot go in. And she said, no, that's my daughter, my daughter's house. I'm going in to see her. Something's wrong. Something's happened. And the police said, no, you're going to come with us. And so they took her away from the house down to actually Danielle Allen's house.
Did Danielle Allen mm-hmm. ever tell you that Brenda had come to her house that night and offered her money to use Danielle Allen's cell phone?
Yes, Danielle told me that. She said she had a wad of cash in her pocket, like $300, because she said that she asked to use her phone and some of the phone calls were long distance. Brenda would offer Danielle money because of the phone calls she had to make. And Danielle said that she refused to take her money.
But she did let her use her phone.
Yeah, she let her use her phone. Here's another thing. The next day, Hannah and her grandmother were supposed to be going to the beach.
Oh, you heard that too?
I heard it from Hannah's grandmother and from Hannah. So Hannah told me that night before when she asked them could she stay over. And when she came out to tell me she could, but she's leaving to go with her grandmother to the beach in the morning. They're leaving early. She was excited, and that was about all that was said. You know, after the murder and everything, she was got the okay that she could go in and clean. A couple neighbors and I, we were walking and we saw her come out. And, you know, that's when she walked down the driveway, like, and she told us, you wouldn't believe all the blood in there on the sheetrock. They're going to have to replace that, the carpet, the tile, and the linoleum, I think they had in the bathrooms. That's all got to be replaced, she said. She said, I mean, there's blood everywhere.
It's a really weird response.
Angel was hypnotized.
Yeah, I knew about that. That's how they got the sketch.
Yeah, and then they found out there was maybe more than one person at that time, too. Is what I was told, that Angel might have saw a second person.
Have you heard any rumors about who could have done this or why?
But I heard different rumors about them saying, like, you know how Matt was really into drugs and stuff back in the day. Someone he knew was in jail, got put in jail, and then somebody said, well, maybe that person got out of jail and came after him.
So person's name?
See, that was just rumors going around. I don't know if I heard that from Danielle or who.
Would you
know?
Remember the name if I said it?
Probably. She lived in Charlotte. So she had a dream at her house that she thought someone, she's like, God woke me up and told me someone was breaking in my house. And she said it wasn't my house. So she said, I got in my car and went to my daughter's because God told me something was wrong there.
So she had originally had a dream that somebody was breaking into her house.
Yes, and then she found out it wasn't her house.
As if this whole scenario wasn't bizarre enough already. But oddly enough, it wasn't exactly what Michelle was saying that struck me. Rather, the chilling realization that I had heard it all before from a source I haven't mentioned yet. A person who contacted me last August. For the purpose of the podcast, we'll call this person Postmark.
Even to this day, her story about waking up and seeing two men in her bedroom has still not been made public. But see, it keeps going back to the same thing. Okay, she wakes up, there's two men in the doorway.
Now, who did you hear that from?
The policeman who took her story.
Thank you.
Later this summer, you'll hear more from Postmark. Unforgotten is a Bold Era production, written and recorded by myself, Freddie Wilson, in the always sunny Daytona Beach, Florida, with special thanks to Michelle and Clay for their contributions to this episode. As always, this series is dedicated to the life of Matt Stewart. May his memory remain unforgotten. If you have any suggestions about topics or questions to be included in future special episodes, you can submit them on the forum located at unforgotten.freeforums.net.